As a leader, you are going to make a difference in people's lives every day. Too many leaders in every profession are trying to.
The state of leadership around the world is leaving teams lost and disengaged. What's missing and how do we fix it? Our guest today, with over 40 years of leadership experience spanning the military and beyond, will reveal the shift leaders need to inspire and drive results. Welcome to the Learn It All podcast, the show for today's leaders who want to get ahead and stay ahead, because great leaders aren't born or made. We are constantly in the making. I'm your host, Damon Lemby. I'm the CEO of Learn It, a live learning platform that has upskilled over 2 million people over the past three decades. In a moment, I'll be joined by retired Lieutenant Colonel Oakland McCulloch, a dedicated military officer with over 40 years of leadership experience, including 23 as a combat arms officer in the U.S. Army. He's the author of a great book called Your Leadership Legacy, and he's a renowned keynote speaker, and he's dedicated to building people-first and purpose-driven teams. I'm going to be asking Oak to share his thoughts on why leadership isn't about you ever. It's about putting your people first. Why leaders should never miss the opportunity to get their own coffee, and the importance of taking full ownership. Own it all. There's no excuses, and you need to set the standards for your team. Oak, I've heard you describe the state of leadership as horrendous around the world. And, you know, honestly, I can't say I disagree. So in your opinion, what is missing and what needs to be changed?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's a two-part to that. I think number one, we got to get back to having servant leaders who understand that it's not about them. It's not about the title they get or the privileges they get or they get more pay. Let's face it, leaders get those things, and that's okay as long as that's not the only reason you want to be the leader. That's the only reason you want to be the leader. Please go do something else. You're not going to be a good one. It's all about you and how you empower the people that you have the privilege to lead, and it is a privilege, and how you run your organization. And we got to get back to having servant leaders who put their people first. In the Army, we had this saying called, it said, mission first, people always. You got to accomplish, I got it. And if you run a business, you got to make money. I got that. You got to be if you want to stay in business, then you got to be successful. But there's no reason that you have to sacrifice taking care of the people that you have the privilege to lead to be successful. And the second part of that I absolutely believe, and there's two words, accountability and responsibility. And accountability is a dirty word in this country today, you know, but we got to start holding people accountable, from the lowest person in the organization that you just hired to the CEO. They all have to be held accountable for their actions, for their performance. And then responsibility, which I think that too many leaders in every profession are trying to pick and choose what they're responsible for. Well, that went well. I'm going to take credit for that. That didn't go well. I'm going to blame Damon for that. Sorry. Leaders don't get to pick and choose what you're responsible for. Your name is on the blame line all the time. You have to own everything that happens in your organization as a leader, good and bad. And that is on you. Even if you weren't the one who messed it up, doesn't matter. You're in charge. You should have seen that coming and helped prevent it. So I think those two words, well, servant leadership and then accountability and responsibility, I see a huge lack in all three of those.
I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And you said so much there. And one of the things that you said was that if people want to be leaders, why do they want to be a leader? Because I've worked with a lot of, especially sales reps, who are fantastic individual contributors who get pushed into a leadership role, and they flat out don't belong in that type of role. And it's a completely different skill set, right?
Absolutely it is. And how do we promote people generally in the business world? It's you got a great salesman who does a great job, and so you promote him up there to the next level without giving him the training.
Mm-hmm.
You're setting them up for failure and your organization up for failure because you haven't trained them. And I see that all the time. And the other piece of that is, I was talking to a guy about 2 months ago. He's got a company here in the Orlando area. And he told me, he said, well, you know, I got great people who fit my culture and who work hard, but they just can't do the job I have them in. And I said, so it sounds like you got the right people on the bus. You just don't have them in the right seats. So, okay, you don't want to get rid of this guy because he's a great worker. He fits your culture. Find a different job for him that he can do, that he will be good at. Or train him to do the job you've got him in so that he does do a good job. But it just comes down to that. I mean, I think a lot of times what I see is owners or businessmen or CEOs, they expect people to meet a standard, but they've never trained them to that standard. How can you hold somebody to a standard that you haven't trained them to? That doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
It makes no sense. You know, I mean, and I see it quite often. Somebody I mentored, they got moved into, promoted, and I asked them why they wanted to be a leader. And they said, well, it'll look good on my LinkedIn profile. I get a little bit of a raise. And I said, this is exactly the wrong reason to do it. They get put into that role. They get no training. 6 months later, you know, his team's frustrated, right? You know, because he's not leading well. And he's even considering leaving the organization because he doesn't feel like he can reach out to the CEO and tell him that they made a mistake. So it's just something that listeners out there, if you're leading a team, you got to be really mindful of who you're promoting and why, and focusing on, like you said, people's strengths.
Yeah, well, and you hit it exactly on the head. Not only is the team frustrated and the owner or whoever promoted them are probably frustrated, but the person is frustrated. They don't want to be in a position that they're not successful at. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't have promoted them because they're hard chargers. They want to do good at whatever it is they do. But if you don't train them, give them the things they need to be successful, they're not going to be unless they just take it on their own to learn those things. But most people don't have time to do that. If you've promoted them, now that they got to learn a whole bunch of new things just for that, they don't have time for their own professional development. So you got to provide that for them.
Well, let's take it back a step. So you have over 40 years of leadership experience. Where did your love of leadership begin?
That's funny. I grew up in a small little farm town in northern Illinois, 1,200 people. And I played baseball, basketball, football in high school, eighth grade in high school. And I was always the captain of my team. And I was the student government president and a student class president. So I kind of got into that leadership stuff just because the coach wanted me to. And I found out I liked it. I liked being able to help people become better at whatever it was, whether it was football, basketball, baseball, whether I could help people as a student class president. And I really, really liked it. And I had two mentors in high school who kind of started me on that servant leadership path. The two that probably had more influence on me as a kid other than my parents was my basketball coach, Coach Terry Nijewicki, who was absolutely, and who I still stay in contact with, who was absolutely understood servant leadership. He understood that, yeah, he was a basketball coach. He needed to produce a good basketball team. But on top of that, he understood that his main job was to create good young men who were going to leave high school and be good husbands, good fathers, good citizens for this country. And he drilled that into us. You know, you do the right thing because it's the right thing to do, not because somebody's watching or because somebody's going to check up on you. If you're the leader, they are watching and they are going to check up on you. But that's not why you do it. You do it because it's the right thing. And the other one was my high school history teacher. And I majored in history in college because of him. There is no doubt about it. And I stayed in contact with him up until about a year ago when he passed away. And he was the same way. He was a very servant leader who understood that it wasn't just about his teaching history in high school. It was about helping young men and women get through that part of their life so that they could move on and be successful afterwards. And I don't care what problem you had. If you had a problem, you could go in his classroom during a break and you could sit down and he would talk to you and give you options. He wouldn't tell you what to do. He gave you options. Well, in my life, I've had something similar to that. And here's the two or three different things that I used. Now it's up to you to figure out which one you want to use, but at least he was there to give you those. So servant leadership been huge for me. And it started in high school. And that's kind of where I got started as a leader. Then as I got ready to graduate from high school, I decided I liked being a leader and I wanted to be a leader. And that's when I decided to go the Army path and be an officer in the Army.
And so, and I love what you're saying, because I kind of reflect back on some of the coaches and leaders I had, and they have such an amazing impact on your life. And what Oak's saying, and I really believe in too, is that, you know, when you're, whether you're leading a team in the business world or you're coaching or you're a parent, you can have such an impact on people's lives. And one of the things you can do as well is help bring out the greatness in people and help them understand what they're capable of achieving. It's so wonderful.
You know, I tell people all the time, as a leader, you are going to make a difference in people's lives every day. Good or bad, and that's your choice. So why not make a conscious decision to make a positive impact on at least one person's life every day? Imagine how much better this world would be, how much better our families, our neighbors, our community, our cities, our state, our country, the world would be if everybody went out one every day, found one person and made a positive impact on their life.
It's interesting that you're so into servant leadership, because you look at your title, you're a retired lieutenant colonel, right? And I think when people think of the Army, I know I did at first, is you think about authoritative leadership, you know, command and control. But here you are talking about servant leadership. So how did that come about for you?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are certainly leaders in the military who are authoritarian, micromanaging, do it exactly as I tell you to do it leaders. But I've been lucky in my life. I had a few of those, and believe me, I didn't like working for those people. But I've had a bunch of leaders in my career who eventually ended up a 2-, 3-, 4-star general who for whatever reason took an interest in me and mentored me, and they were servant leaders. And they understood that it wasn't about them, it was about the team and about the people they had the privilege to lead. And one of them one day told me, he said, "Oak, the leadership is on a scale." He said, "On this end of the scale, you have that authoritarian, micromanaging, do it exactly as I tell you how to do it type of leader." He said, "And on that end of the scale, you have no creativity in your organization." He said, "Nobody's going to stick their neck out there. Nobody's going to come up with ideas, because they're just going to wait for you to tell them exactly what to do, when to do it, how to do it. Get no creativity whatsoever." And he said, "On this end of the scale, you have Attila the Hun and chaos, controlled chaos, but chaos." He said, "And that's where you want to be, because that's where creativity happens. That's where you're using other people's skills, other people's knowledge, other people's abilities. And I don't care how long you've been doing whatever you're doing, you don't have all the answers, I promise you. If you think you do, you need to go do something else." And he said, "And the way you get there," which is kind of goes back to what we talked about in the beginning, "how you get there is, number one, is that you build a culture that everybody understands, so you know when they make a decision, they're going to make it inside of the culture that is acceptable for that organization. You train them to the standard that you want them to meet, so you know they can meet the standard you're asking them to do. You give them the resources that they need, time, money, people, equipment, whatever it is. You give them authority." That's where a lot of leaders don't want to give away their authority. You have, as a leader, authority by your title. But you can give it away, let people use that authority to get that job done that you've asked them to do. If you don't give them the authority, then they're not really the leader of that project or job or whatever it is you've asked them to do. He said, "And then you get out of their way and you let them do it." He said, "Will they do it exactly the way you would have done it? Absolutely not. But who cares?" And the analogy that I always use is if you got to get me to the number 9, if my team has to get me to the number 9, why do I care how you get me to 9? 7 plus 2 is 9, but so is 6 plus 3 and 5 plus 4 and 8 plus 1. I don't care how you get me there. Stay inside the culture, use the resources that I gave you, and get me to 9. That's all I care about. And that's what happens when you're that type of servant leader who understands that it's not about you and that you don't have all the answers. The problem that we have in the military and in business today is that leaders can't put their ego aside to ask other people for ideas and use other people's knowledge, skills, and abilities. And look, we all have an ego. Anybody who tells you they don't have an ego is lying to you. We all have an ego, and we want people to have an ego because that's what drives them to be successful. That's what drives them to be the best at whatever they want to do. But good leaders know when to put that ego aside and use other people's knowledge, skills, and abilities.
And so are you saying that they're not willing to hand off authority because of ego? Is there anything else that's preventing that from happening?
I do. I think that we have gotten to a point in this country where it's cover my butt. If I make a mistake, I might not get... If my organization doesn't do exactly what we need it to do, then I may not get my next promotion. I may not get my next pay raise. Again, going back to the selfish piece of it instead of selfless service, very selfish part of it. And the thing I always, I've had my hand in commissioning over 600 lieutenants for the Army and for the nation. And I used to tell every single one of them, if you do what I'm telling you to do, if you're a servant leader and you take care of people, you will get your next promotion. You will get your next pay raise because you're going to make people better, who then going to make the organization better, and you're going to get credit for it because you are responsible for everything that happens or doesn't happen in your organization. But you get your promotion and your pay raise for the right reason, not because you were selfish, but because you took care of the people in your organization.
So, Oak, if I'm a leader and I'm listening to you speak and I'm thinking to myself, well, you know what? I kind of fall in line with what Oak's saying. I tend to jump in and do the work. So how do you help them? What's some practical advice you can give to them to correct that? Some steps moving forward to stop being that way and, you know, start delegating and giving people the space to try things and even make mistakes.
Absolutely. I think, you know, it is, and look, I'm guilty just like anybody else. I mean, we've all handed a job or a task or a project to somebody and you really see them struggling. And you know you could do that in 15, 20 minutes. And it's so hard not to walk up and say, get out of my way. I'll take care of that. But when you do that, you're not helping anybody. You're not helping them. You're not helping the organization. And you certainly aren't helping yourself. And I always call that the evil of micromanaging. Because when you micromanage people, not only have you cheated them out of that experience, now you're going to cheat everybody who ever worked for that person out of that experience because they don't have it to pass on. So you may be affecting your organization for the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. So you got to avoid the micromanaging whenever possible. But I think to your point, ways to get there is make a conscious effort. The next time you get an assignment from your boss, go to your junior leaders and say, okay, guys, gals, this is what we got to do. Give me some ideas. And let them throw out ideas. Couple things about that, at least in my experience. Every once in a while, you're going to do that, and the guy you think is, or a gal you think is the superstar in your organization is going to give you a horrible idea. And the person that you think is the weakest link will give you a great idea. And again, I had a boss who retired, a 4-star general, who told me one time, he said, Oak, a good idea is a good idea, whether it comes from a private, the lowest ranking person, or a general, a highest ranking person. And he said, and a bad idea is a bad idea, whether it comes from a private or a general. And he said, you don't have to take any of their suggestions, but at least you asked. When you do that, two things happen. Number one, you start to build the trust in that organization. You ask them their opinion. Even if you didn't use it this time, you might use it next time, but you ask them their opinion, which doesn't happen a whole lot anymore in this world, from what I can see. And number two, what generally I see happen, at least what's happened with me, is I'll use a little bit of your idea and a little bit of somebody else's idea and a little bit of my idea, and we'll blend it together, and that's our solution. And what you just did was, it's no longer Colonel McCullough's solution. It is our solution. We all had a say in it. We all got to voice our opinion. Now they got skin in the game. Now there's a reason for them to be successful at what they're doing, because they had some say in it. And you will see not only the trust and the enthusiasm go through the roof, but you'll also see a performance improvement as well.
What I want to add to that is, I think that, and when that, whatever it is, comes to fruition, that, like you said earlier, you give them credit for it.
Absolutely.
And when you give them credit for it, that's when ideas start bubbling up from everywhere. And people are bought in, and they're not paycheck players, right? They're coming in. And I love what you said. I mean, you get people from all areas coming up with ideas, and just being open to them. You don't have to use all of them, but sometimes you can even mesh them together. You give them the credit. And if it doesn't work, like you said, then you take the blame for it. You're responsible.
Yeah. In my career, my philosophy has always been this. If my team didn't accomplish what it was supposed to accomplish, I go to my boss in front of my team and I say, "Hey, boss, my bad. But this is how we're going to fix it." If we were successful, then I said, "Hey, boss, look what my guys and gals did. And oh, by the way, John, Damon, and Joe did a great job." And you'd be surprised what that does for people. It really does.
Yeah, it means the world to them. I mean, it shows that you respect them. It shows that you believe in them. And
yeah,
it really pumps them up. Now, I've also heard you talk about, you know, getting to know your people and why that's important. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I think leadership is very simple. It's about people and trust, period. End of story. You can throw some other stuff in there that's nice, but those two things have to happen. You got to take care of your people, and they got to trust you. If that doesn't happen, it doesn't matter. So to me, this human nature, you're not going to trust somebody you don't know. I mean, I don't. You know, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt until you prove me otherwise, but I can't say that I truly trust you until you prove yourself to me. And one of the ways, again, I had a boss who retired, a 2-star general, and he said to me one time, he said, "Oak," he said, you gotta get out from behind your desk and go out where they are. Let them see you in their environment. Because I promise you, you call somebody into your office and you ask them a question, you will get an entirely different answer than if you ask that question down there where they're working. Because when you call them into your office, it's like going to the principal's office. You know, they think they're in trouble, and they're automatically on the defensive. They're not going to talk to you openly like they will down wherever they're working. And he said, there's a couple ways to do that. There's a couple ways to learn about people. And he said, number one, he said, get out from behind your office, go down where they're working, and spend time with them. He said, another way, he said, I don't care how high up in the organization you get, never, ever, ever turn down a chance to go get your own cup of coffee. He said, two things happen when you do that. Number one, you're showing the people that work for you, you are no better than they are. You got to go get your own cup of coffee just like they do. He said, and if you're lucky, you got 2 or 3 different ways to get to the coffee pot and back to your office. And along the way, you stop and talk to people. And he said, the advice I always gave these young lieutenants when they were walking out the door, getting ready to go take their first platoon in the Army, I said, your goal should be every day, go out and find one person in your organization and find out something new about them. Not about work, about their personal life. What's their spouse's name? What's their kid's name? What sports do their kids play? What's their hobbies? What are they good at? What don't they like? What do they like? You get to know that person. And the downside to that, which is why a lot of leaders won't do that, is you've got to share some of that stuff yourself, because they got to get to know you as well. And I see a lot of leaders, and I got it. You got to have the leader-led relationship. I got that. But that doesn't mean that you can't get to know the people on a personal level. And you have to do that. And here's the problem if you don't do that. And I see it all the time, and I bet you've seen it as well, and I'm sure I've been guilty of it in the past, is I'll be in a meeting and I'll assign somebody a job or a project, and that is not the right project for them. The person sitting right next to them, that would have been a perfect project for them. But because I didn't know them yet, I gave somebody the wrong thing, the thing that they don't like or they're not good at, or with a guy who or gal sitting right next to them, that might be their strength. The only way you get to know that is to get to know them.
And one thing about that too that's really important, Oak, is when you take the time to ask them questions, is to make sure that you're present when you listen to them. I don't think there's anything worse than asking Bob, "Hey Bob, how are your kids?" And then they see you look down and type in an email over somewhere else. I mean, that just defeats the whole purpose. You know, be present, get to know them. And I think that that helps too, because what happens in your personal life, and this isn't woo-woo, what happens in your personal life could affect what's going on at work. And I think great leaders know that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, the thing that taught me this above anything else, I was a captain in the Army, and I just got to a new duty station. And the lieutenant colonel, who was my boss that I reported to, one day I was walking into the building right after I got there, not too long after I got there. And then my family got there about 2 months after I got there. So it was about two and a half months after I'd been in there. And I walked by him and he said, "How you doing, Oak?" And I said, "Fine." And I kept walking. And he said, no. He said, "Come on back here. How you doing? I want to know. Tell me how you're doing." And I'm sitting there talking to him. And he asked me about my wife, Kelly. He asked me about my kids. And he was a busy man. Not one time did I see him look down at his watch like he had somewhere better to be. During that 10, 15 minutes, whatever it was, I was the most important thing on his agenda that day. And I felt it. It wasn't just, because you can't fake stuff like that. You might be able to fake it for a short period of time, but people will figure out whether or not you really care about them or not. And this guy did. And no surprise, he retired a 3-star general, and I worked with him several different times throughout my career, and I would have worked if he calls me today and asked me to come work for him, I'd be there. I mean, he was that type of leader. And it was because he took the time to get to know us, and we really were that important to him. I mean, and that's where I first learned it. And I always tried to make sure of that. And you know, your point is exactly right. Communication is huge, and listening is probably the most important part of the communication for a leader. You got to be able to listen to people.
Yeah, I mean, some of the greatest leaders, I think, in the world, they've been known to, when they speak to you, you're the only person in the room, you know,
and
just the impact that has on their individual, you know. So we're talking about people and trust, right? I mean, I think trust is incredibly important. And we talked about some of the things of how to build trust. But let's talk a little bit about 360 of trust.
Yeah. So when I talk about trust, I always talk about it in a circle, 360-degree circle. And I think everybody who's a leader understands that the people that you lead have to trust you.
And first,
that is the most important. If that one's not there, nothing else matters. I mean, because you're not really their leader if they don't trust you. You might have the title, but you're not their leader. So that one, I think everybody understands and believes. But just as importantly, if you go back to what I'm talking about with the creativity and servant leadership, is that the leader has to trust the people that they're leading. You have to trust that they're going to do the right thing, that they're going to make good decisions, that they're going to work hard and accomplish the things you ask them to accomplish. And I think a lot of leaders kind of forget that trust has to be there as well. And you have to develop that trust. That isn't just something that comes. Then the third part of that 360-degree circle is that everybody on the team has to trust each other, that they're going to do the right thing. They're going to make good decisions. They're going to pull their weight. They're going to do all the things that need to be done to make that a team, a true team. And then the last piece, especially for businesses, is that You got to trust the people outside your organization that you're going to do business with, and they certainly have to trust you. I hope you wouldn't do business with somebody you don't trust. And neither will they. If they don't trust you and your organization, then they're not going to do business with you. If any part of that 360-degree circle is broken, you got problems in your organization. It is not as effective or efficient as it could be.
Well, what do you say? And I see this a lot. And I sometimes I'm in wonderment about it, where an organization has toxic employees, top producers, and they allow them to stay. What does that do to trust and the overall culture?
Yeah, it destroys that company, that organization. You know, I forget who said it. Some famous quote: the fastest way to demoralize your people is to let them see you accept toxic leadership or bad leadership. And I absolutely agree with that. And it starts with you setting the example, which again is part of servant leadership. But I think you got to get rid of those people. And I had a case in the food bank where I had a lady had been there for 32 years or something like that. I mean, and had all kinds, had more knowledge about that organization than anywhere else. And shortly after I got there, I realized she was toxic and she was not a team player. And she was one of those knowledge is power brokers. You know, if I got all the knowledge, then you can't touch me. Well, I fired her. And she said, well, you can't fire me. I know things that nobody else in this organization knows. And I said, I know that. I said, and I didn't say this was going to be fun or easy. It's going to be painful. And it was for a couple months. It was very painful while we were trying to figure out what she did, who she talked to. But once we did and we distributed it, all that stuff to the other people who were team players, the organization was much better. But you're going to pay a price, you know. But in the long run, the price you pay for getting rid of those people is not nearly as bad as the price you pay for keeping it.
Absolutely. The short-term gains aren't worth the long-term erosion of trust and what you're doing to your culture. And everybody sees, right? Everybody sees that if you allow that to happen, then they're going to start thinking, maybe I don't have to do things with integrity. Maybe I can do this, you know? And it's just it's a slippery slope. Now,
it's a vicious cycle.
It's a vicious cycle. Yeah.
And I talk about this a lot when I give my talks. I say, look, and I see it in every profession, including the military today, this vicious cycle that we're in, where you get a toxic leader who drives out the good junior leaders who say, I'm out of here.
They don't want to be there. We'll find something else to do.
So who stays? Your average or below average people who then get promoted because they're the ones that stayed. And they're learning from this toxic leader how to be a leader, so they become a toxic leader, which then drives out the next generation of good leaders. And it's just that vicious cycle that goes round and round and round, and you got to break that cycle. If you don't break that cycle, your organization is in deep trouble.
Absolutely. And one thing that I think you should do as well as a leader is be proactive in making sure that, like that woman from the food bank, doesn't have all the knowledge. You know, I mean, you gotta be careful of that, because then
you're creating the monster.
You're creating the monster, right? You'd be able to have that distributed. Now, servant leadership, obviously, I think it's fantastic. You know, people first, of course. We also need to make sure things get done, right? So how do you balance the making sure you take care of your people, make sure you believe in them, give them psychologically safe space or whatever you want to call it, but also they need to execute, because without results, I don't know what to tell you.
You're out of business.
You're out of business. So,
and again, I'm a very result-oriented person. I got to take care of my people, but we got to meet the mission, the job, the task, whatever I got to get done. And I always tell people, look, you know, that is non-negotiable. We have to be successful. As a kid, my dad beat that into me, sometimes literally, that you got to be the best at whatever it is you do. growing up, I had this thing called the 75% rule is what my dad had. And I lived by it all my life as a kid and throughout my career in the Army and beyond. And I try to pass it on to my kids and my grandkids. And his 75% rule was, look, if you can't do something better than 75% of the people doing it, then you need to go do one of two things. You either need to figure out how to get better at it, or you need to go do something else, because obviously it doesn't matter to you. And I believe that. I worked toward that. And, you know, one day I was I was complaining to him over the phone about something. I was in the Army, and I had a job that I really didn't want, and I was whining. And he said, son, stop whining. He said, I don't care if they make you have you sweep the motor pool. Be the best motor pool sweeper the Army has. He said, I don't care what it is. If you go at it with that attitude that I'm going to be the best at whatever I do, you're going to get promoted. You're going to get recognized. You're going to do, even in those crappy jobs that you don't really want. And I think part of that piece of getting results, go back to the culture piece, we have gone away from the winning culture.
Amen.
Yeah. We no longer, it's not about winning and getting results. It's about making people feel good and whatever else, you know. You know, it goes back to the everybody gets a trophy.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Mentality that, you know, not everybody deserves a trophy. We are not all champions. Sorry. You know, I actually said that to somebody at a conference. I get in trouble sometimes. And this lady walks up to me and says, you know, I said, we're not all champions. And she said, well, you know, you got to make people feel good. I said, you want to make them feel good? Make them work for it. Make them understand that you're not just going to give them things. They got to actually do stuff. And if they rise to the top, they get promoted. If they don't, then they stay in where they are. They might get a pay raise, but they're staying where they are. And I think we got to get back to that winning attitude that I'm going to be the best at whatever I do. Look, I want to win all the time. I don't care if I'm playing old maid with my 10-year-old granddaughter. I want to win, okay? I'm not letting her win. You should have seen the look on her face the first time she beat me, because she knew she beat me. She knew I just didn't let her win. That's what drives people to be successful. And we got to get back to that culture of that winning culture, that winning attitude. And if we don't, then we're going to continue to have companies and organizations and that are failing and struggling, because people are there to draw a paycheck. They're not there to be the best they can be and make the organization the best they can be. Got to get back to that.
You got to. I mean, I think if you would ask me the question I asked you about what's missing, and I think one of the big things is that we don't have that competitive, you know, win. No, I'm not saying win at all costs and do things illegal or with a lack of integrity.
You got to stay in the culture.
Yeah.
And again, it goes back to doing the right thing, because it's the right thing to do. But you got to have that drive to be successful, to be the best. To you know, again, I told somebody, you know, I said, you are going to be judged against other people who are doing the same job you are, or at least you should be. That's how we should pick promotions. That's how we should pick pay raises. And this young lady walked up to me and she said, Colonel McCullough, I don't judge myself against other people. I only judge myself against myself. And I said, you absolutely should. That's the 75% rule. Every day you should judge yourself that I want to be a little bit better at whatever it is you choose to do. I said, however, if you believe that the people that you work for aren't judging you against other people who are doing the same thing you are pretty naive, because we do, and we should. And she didn't like that answer, but that's okay.
No, I couldn't agree more. I was very fortunate. I got to know Joe Montana very well. And he came over one time. This is back when I was back in college, when I was playing baseball. We had a barbecue. He came over. And he came and he played ping pong with the guys on my baseball team. And Oak, he wanted to win. You know, there was not, it didn't matter. I mean, it didn't matter what he was doing. He wanted to make sure he won, or he did everything he could, you know. And I just think that is it's important mentality that I think that we need to get back to.
Are you going to win every time? No. We also got to learn how to be gracious losers. in those things too. But then going back to being the best you can be, that's, you can learn the lessons from that by reflecting on it. I told somebody one time the importance of reflection, and I believe in reflection 100%. I've added it to my daily life, not just my work life. And it will change your life. It really will. But I said, you got to reflect on the things you did. Because somebody, and what brought it up was somebody said, well, I learned from so many experiences. I said, no, you didn't. You didn't learn from any experience. Because experience is full of emotions. You learned from the reflection on that experience. Take yourself out of it. Take a step back and say, what was I supposed to do? What did I do? How can I get better at it? And even if you're successful, you can always get better at it. So every time I did an event, every time I did a major thing, I reflected. And then I thought to myself, well, if it works there, why doesn't it work on my daily life? And so, you know, I'm no surprise, 40 years of service to the Army. I'm a guy of routines. I believe in routines inside of routines. So I start my day and end my day the exact same way every single day, no matter where I am in the world, no matter what I'm doing. I get up, I pour my cup of coffee, I sit down, and I listen to the daily mass. I read a couple of chapters of the Bible, and then I do my daily prayers. Now, I may not have a whole lot of influence on what happens after that, but I started the day right. Then I go through my day, and at the end of the day, before I go to bed at night, I read something of whatever I'm reading, whether it's a blog, an article, a chapter of the book that I'm reading, whatever it is. I read something every day. I do my journal, because I do a journal every day. I have since I was 10 years old. Every day I write in my journal. And then the last thing I do before I go to bed is I reflect on my day. What was I supposed to do? What did I do? How can I get better at it tomorrow? And I will tell you, if you do that, it will change your life, I promise you. Now, you got to be honest. You got to be honest with yourself. That's key. I mean, you can play games all you want. That's not going to help you. You got to be honest. What did I do? What should I have done? And how can I get better at it? And you got to be honest. And if you are, it will change your life.
What you just said there is so key about being honest, because I think a lot of times people aren't honest with themselves. They want to play the victim. They want to blame somebody else. So if you're reflecting back and you're blaming somebody else on it, then you're just wasting your time is really what
absolutely.
You're doing.
You know? You're not learning anything from that.
Not learning anything. So, Oak, let's say I'm somebody who doesn't have any routines and I'm like, oh my gosh, this sounds great. But, you know, having all these routines like Oak does, I don't think I can get there. What is one step? What's the first step they could take to start on that journey?
Yeah, well, start small. Just one simple thing. You know, growing up, I never made my bed, ever. Didn't happen. Went in the Army, guess what?
Every day.
Yeah. Started making my bed. Yeah. That's where it starts. One thing. Just pick one thing and start that as your routine. And then when you get that down, and it is a routine, it's habit at that point, pick another thing and work on that. And I think if you approach it that way, then I think you'll be okay. And look, we are all creatures of habit. Okay. Anybody who tells you they aren't is lying to you. We are all creatures of habit. You just got to pick the habits that are good and then turn them into a routine. And again, I'm a firm believer in routines inside a routine. So like when I'm home, I do my morning routine in the exact same place, doing the exact same thing every morning. You know, I sit in my chair. It's the only thing in my house that is mine.
I'm the same way.
I know my place, and I do. Yeah. This isn't my place. That chair is mine. I mean, then at night, I'm sitting in my office. I do my reading in here. I do my journal in here, and I do my reflection. And I think if you get into those type of habits where you're doing the same thing the same way, it does become a habit. And then you can work on the bad habits that you have to try to get rid of, but you try to instill habits that are good for you and you turn them into routines so that if you, you know, there have been times where when I'm traveling, sometimes I got to be at the airport at 3 o'clock in the morning. Well, I don't have time to do all my routine in the morning before I leave for the airport. But as soon as I get there, I stop, and during the 2 hours I'm waiting for my flight, then I'll read a couple chapters of the Bible or say my prayers or whatever. And the mornings I have to do that, it messes me up that I didn't do them all at the same time in the same place, the same way. So you'll get to the point where your mind will drive you to make routines, to do it every single day. And it will get there. It may take a month or so, but you will get there, I promise you.
No, I think that that's it's great. And I like what you said about starting small. So, Oak, you've got a great book, came out in 2021, I believe, called Your Leadership Legacy. What inspired you to write your book?
Yeah, that's funny. It's a good question, because I always thought I wanted to write that book, you know, with all of my years of leadership. I thought, you know, I need to pass some of these lessons down. And I'm very proud to say that I don't talk about theory whatsoever in my book. I don't even think I mentioned the word theory in my book. It's all about everyday things that every leader can do to improve their leadership skills and ability and to empower the people they have the privilege to lead. And so I always knew I wanted to write that book. And in the back of my mind, I was always like, yeah, I'm going to write that book. And what really drove me to do it finally was my wife and I and her mom and two other ladies who live here in our condo building. We went to this 3-hour event at our Catholic church that was kind of a combination of motivational speaking plus how do we revitalize the Catholic church. And the guy who gave it, great speaker, Jonathan Fanning, he gave he was the only guy that talked throughout the whole thing. Now, he didn't talk for 3 straight hours. He talked for 40, 45 minutes. We took a 15, 20-minute break. He'd talk again. We'd take a break. He'd talk again. And he did that 3 times. And every time that he talked, we'd take a break, I would go up and pick his brain because he was doing what I wanted to do, get out in front of people and talk about how to improve yourself and how to be better at what you do. And so I picked his brain, and he gave me some great intel and some great information that I still use today. And at the end of it, at the very end, I said thank you, and we said our goodbyes, and he started to walk away, and he turned around and he looked at me and he said, Oak, have you written a book? And I said, no, Jonathan, but I'm thinking about it. He said, stop thinking about it and write it. And so I went home that night on the 15th of February, and I wrote out the table of contents. On the next day, on the 16th, I started writing that book. And that was the 16th of February, 2020. And I published the book on the 12th of February, 2021. So just under a year from the time I started till the time I published it.
And what I think is great about your book, and like what Oak said, is that, you know, everybody's got theory, whatever, right? But it's so impactful when you get a book that you could use, right, Oak? Like a handbook, a playbook, where something comes up. Here's some real-world practical advice, actionable tips that can actually benefit people.
Well, I've had people actually tell me that they've read it multiple times. They've highlighted it. They've shown me their book. It's highlighted. It's tabbed. And they say they keep it on their desk at work. And, you know, they run into things that, you know, is it the exact same situation I was in? No, but could you use that I used in that situation? And they said they find it all the time. And one of the great things for me as the author, you know, when I sat down and wrote it, I thought I was writing it for young aspiring leaders or leaders who just took over their first organization. And if you read my reviews for the book, I think I hit that target. I mean, that's people say that. But the two things that really made me feel good was I had a full bird colonel from the Air Force who said, I wish I would have had this book when I was a lieutenant. He said, it would have saved me a lot of trouble and a lot of pain. And then I had a 2-star general from the Marine Corps who read it and contacted me on LinkedIn after he read it. And he said, you know, Oak, I didn't learn a whole lot of new things. He said, I learned a few new techniques and things that I can use. He said, but what I really took out of your book was this. As I was reading along, I'd come across something and I'd say to myself, you know what? I used to do that really well, and I don't do that so well anymore. Maybe I need to dedicate some time to get back to doing that. And we all need that little nudge every once in a while to remind us what made us successful. Because we get busy, whatever. We forget those little things that really made a difference in our career and the people that we serve. And every once in a while, we need that nudge to get back to doing those things.
That's great self-reflection right here, right there. Now, I've got a question, and I can't take credit for it. There's a sandwich shop down the street, and a young lady there heard I wrote a book. I gave her my book, and then a couple weeks later, she asked me, she said, okay, your book's been out a while now. Is there anything in your book, I'm asking you, Oak, that you no longer subscribe to, that you've changed your mind on, or anything that you've really doubled down on over the last 3 years?
Yeah. It's funny that you asked that question, because my wife is going through my journals right now, all from when I was 10 years old. She's going through and she's pulling out like 15, 20 things every year. She's going to write a book about my life. That's her project, not mine. And it may only be for our kids and our grandkids, you know, relatives. We may not even publish it, but she wanted to put something in writing so that they could. And she said, I can see where you change some things throughout your time. You know, now maybe you have a little more empathy for somebody, or, you know, your views on this or that has changed. And I think that's just normal. Is there anything in the book that I would change, that I would take out, that I don't believe in anymore? I don't think so. There are certainly things that I wish I would have put in that I didn't, because just like everybody else, I'm growing every day as a leader. When I go to a conference as the keynote speaker, I go to the breakout sessions, and I'm sitting there with a notepad and I'm taking notes, because I can learn just as much from them as they can from me. And I picked some things up that helped me as a leader. In fact, one of them, I was taking notes, and it was before I gave my talk. I was in his breakout session. I'm taking notes, and after I gave my talk, he walked up to me and he said, you know, I didn't realize that you were the keynote speaker. He said, I saw you in my breakout session and you were taking notes. And I'm thinking, what's this guy? Who is this guy and why is he taking notes? And I told him, I said, because I can learn just as much from you as you can from me. And I learned some things, but I always have a notepad and I'm taking notes. And you know where that came from? I was a captain in the Army, and I got the opportunity to listen to General Hal Moore talk. And for those of you in your audience who don't know who Hal Moore was, that movie, We Were Soldiers Once and Young, that Mel Gibson played, that was Lieutenant Colonel Hal Moore he was playing in the Vietnam War. And they just renamed Fort Benning after General Moore. So, I mean, that's the statue of this guy. And probably one of the greatest combat generals that our country has ever produced. And so I'm sitting there, I'm in the front row because I got there early. I wanted to be in the front row to listen to General Moore talk. And I'm sitting there in the front row, and my boss walks by, Lieutenant Colonel, and he walks by and he says, Oak, what are you doing? And I said, well, sir, I'm sitting here in the front row waiting for General Moore to talk. And he said, no, what are you doing? He said, probably the greatest combat general this country's ever produced is about to talk to you, and you don't have anything to write with. Shame on you. Never happened again.
Never happened again. So that's a great story. Oak, what does legacy mean to you?
Yeah, that's, you know, obviously that means something to me. That's why I named the book that. And I think legacy has two parts. One is, go back to what this discussion we just had, what you do as the leader in your organization. That's part of your legacy. But I think it's a very small part of your legacy. Because if I'm the leader and I do these things, but you come in after me as the leader and you change all of that, then where's my legacy? It's not really there anymore. So I, but results do matter in the real world. Results do matter. Maybe in fantasy land where everybody's a winner and everybody gets a trophy, maybe not. But in the real world, results do matter. So that's part of your legacy. Were you successful? Did you do the things you should have done and helped the organization get where it needs to be? The second part, which I think is the most important part of your legacy, is that next generation of leaders that you help create. In your image, in servant leadership, that they do the right thing, they set the example. Because if that is your legacy, you could be affecting that organization for 10, 15, 20, 30 years, as long as they work there. And if they leave your organization and they take it to the next organization, you're affecting that organization. And where that, and I always believe that. In the back of my mind, in my heart, I believe that. But what really drove that home to me, my last duty assignment on active duty, I ran an Army ROTC program at the University of South Alabama in Mobile. And my second in command, Master Sergeant David Powell, and I were sitting there, and we were talking about the significance of what we were doing, creating that next generation of leaders for the Army and for the nation. And he looked over at me and he said, and I said he worked for me. He was probably a better leader than I was. But he said to me, he said, "Sir, you know, great leadership handed down from generation to generation is what develops great nations." And I thought, wow, what a powerful quote. I wish I could take credit for that, but I can't. It was Master Sergeant David Powell, who I still stay in contact with. But then I thought to myself, you know what the most powerful part of that quote is? You could take that word nations and you could substitute anything you want for it. A business, a hospital, a food bank, a university, doesn't matter. Because every organization in every profession needs good leadership. And that is your legacy, that next generation that you help create. Who's then going to create the next generation? And then they're going to create the next generation. That is your legacy.
No, that's super powerful. And I have one last question for you, and we got to wrap up. And I've had an amazing time with you. I've got two kids. I got a 7-year-old and a 3-year-old. You know, I'm a late starter. Okay. And my, you know, at LearnIt, we develop leaders and everybody. I mean, my mission is really to develop great leaders for the future, because I want my kids and their kids and all of our kids to live in a better world than we do now. For our listeners out there, what is one piece of advice that they could start tomorrow to help build better leaders so we have a stronger future for our kids in our future generations?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. I get asked that quite often. And not even when I'm out talking on just people who randomly who knows what I do, they ask me that question. And this is the answer I always give them. Go back to values, because it all starts there. Values, morals, ethics. Because that's how you create that servant leader, is you teach them that they got to do the right thing. But if they don't know what the right thing is, then how do they know what to do? You know, and I just had this conversation last week, funny enough. And I said, look, the founding fathers knew that that was the key. You know, Jefferson said that a free society has to have a moral society. The people have to be moral. They have to be living by the moral standards that everybody understands what it is and everybody lives by them. And if you don't have that, then you fall into the individual identity syndrome that we're in today, where you can't tell me what's right or wrong. I decide for myself what's right or wrong. And then you just, the society at that point just dissolves into anarchy and people doing bad things. And we got to get back to teaching our, and it's, and leadership starts at home. I mean,
100%.
Your children are watching you every single day, whether you like it or not, whether you believe it or not, that you're their role model. You're their first role model. And so it's got to start there, and you got to instill those morals, ethics, and the way of life for your family. And if you do that, I think they're on the right path.
Thank you for that, Oak. And I totally agree with you. And I think it's important too for us parents to be present when we're home. You know, we get caught up a lot and they see
that. You know, that is a great point as well. You know, because in the Army, I didn't have the choice of when I could be home and when I couldn't, you know. I didn't see my daughter until she was 5 months old because I was in the first Gulf War. Didn't have the choice. So what I tell people, you know, these people who stand up on a stage and tell you you got to have this perfect life-work balance, run away from those people. You know, a four-star general gets up there and tells me about life, work-life balance. I said, yeah, right, that's how you made four stars. Stop. I don't want to hear it. That's a bunch of crap.
Yeah.
However, what I say is that if you're in those type of positions where you don't have complete control of your schedule and you're not going to be home every night or maybe a month at a time, then when you are home, you need to be present. That needs to be your priority when you're home. Understanding that next month I may not be home, but when I'm there, I am there and I'm there for them. I go to their ball games. I go to their play. I go to church with them. All those things that you can do when you're there, you got to do because you don't always have that choice.
And time goes by quick. So, Oak, this is awesome. You're awesome. I mean, we talked everything about people, trust, servant leadership, you know, getting back to learning how to win. I can't wait to bring you in to have you speak to my team at Learn It, right? So for others out there who want to connect with you, what are the best ways to connect with you?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm on all the social media, but I really, the one we met on was LinkedIn. I mean, that's the one I do most of my stuff on. So, you know, as far as I know, there's only one Oakland McCullough on LinkedIn. So I shouldn't be that hard to find. And just contact me either with a direct message or ask me to connect with you, and I will. And then we can start that conversation. And then I got my website, which has all of my social links to all my social media, and it has my cell phone number and my email address. And if you want me to come talk, we can work that out. But even if you just have a question, I have a rule. If somebody connects with me on LinkedIn and they want to hop on a Zoom meeting, I never turn them down. You know, we might only end up with one meeting. There's about 10 people that I do monthly meetings with now because we connected and I can help them. They can help me, you know, but I always try to at least one time I will get on a Zoom with anybody who asks me because it's about people. And if I can help one person, then that's worth me doing.
Well, I could say from personal experience, I reached out to you on LinkedIn about 3 hours later, you responded. And so I appreciate it. So listeners, as we wrap up here, if you enjoy the show, of course, you know, subscribe and give us a rating. But also what I want you to do is think about somebody who could benefit from our conversation with Oak today and send them this episode because I guarantee they'll get value out of it. I mean, I loved it. I had a great time. And so until next time, everybody, stay curious and keep learning. Have a great day.